From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If the devil was in the air on September 11th, where the hell was God? Americans of every faith wanted to know that and more 1 year ago, when devastation and terror forced America out from under the protective garb of adolescence and into the wilderness of adulthood. Believers and non-believers alike struggled to make sense, turning to God, filling houses of worship, buying copies of the Quran. They looked inward, too, challenging themselves to appreciate the lives and loves and families they already had, to make every day count. As the collective pace of an overachieving fast food nation slowed, as kindness stepped in to counter the inevitable fury that was just one reaction to September 11th, America took on the sheen of self-awareness and self-discovery. So where's it all gone? 1 year later, is America soul-searching still? What did you demand of God, of yourself, after 9/11? Where do you see the soul of the nation turning now? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from the studios of WNYC in New York City is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. It's been quite a day there, Jack. We've all seen and heard New York on TV and radio. You were there. What did you see? What did you feel firsthand?
Well, it was a day of sun, wind, and thick skirls of dust here. And the wind played havoc with the flags. As early as 8 o'clock this morning, two flags on one building facing the World Trade Center just blew over. One, the wind rolled it up like a rug, and the other one, the stanchion, blew away, and the flag just went away. And then later this afternoon, most troublingly of all, this huge American flag, perhaps 50 feet across, right a flank the World Trade Center, the Ground Zero, split in half. And suddenly in the middle there was this black void that split right at the stars and bars, a kind of shaking augury. We in the crowd were kind of kept out of things. We couldn't look in. The loudspeakers were patchy at best. We couldn't really hear what was going on. And we stood there for hours and hours and sort of, well, did what we could. And one of the things we did was we applauded every fireman who came by, every policeman, sanitation workers, construction workers. Heck, we applauded the dogs. But we'd be caught in moments where we'd be applauding the firemen, and there would come the families, as everyone called them. Mm-hmm. After the, you know, you'd see a group of firemen in fraternity, and here'd be a woman all alone with a ribbon. Or a cat, or a woman with a stroller with the ribbon on the baby, and you realize the real consequences of this.
Was it grief today, Jack, or a sense of passage through grief to some new phase?
Well, it was. It was hard to keep back tears, especially when we heard the names that they would come in. You know, there they were: the Rosenthals, the Rosenbergs, the Rosenblums, 10 Kellys, 6 Wongs, the
Viglianos,
the Vegas, the Browns, 10 Smiths, the city's patchwork fraternity, and. Occasionally you'd hear the wind would blow them the mic. You could hear the loudspeakers and it would waft in. But for me, the day was sort of built around a man we met who called David, who was a construction worker who came on the first day and spent the first 3 weeks of September right there. Spent 9 days in a row on the site and had photographs. And he told us about his boots. He had to get 3 different pairs of boots because it was so hot it burned right through the sole. He told us about the dogs. 300 dogs were there, and the dogs would work for 18 hours at a time and still be trying to find. And when I asked him how he was feeling, he looked at me as if I'd asked a totally irrelevant question. He's fine. And to show what the guy was made of, there was a woman with a bag, and she had petals of flowers in the bag. And when the firemen would go by, she'd throw the petals of flowers at them. And she began to break up and cry, and out reached the hand of this construction worker and took her hand, the muscles tightening, and held it. And you thought, this is the kind of man that you build a world around. Very, very moving scene.
The stuff of saga and legend, and we hope of moving on to. What about elsewhere around New York, Jack, away from Ground Zero today?
Well, as you walked around, there was the city's past everywhere. They're looming over everything. The Woolworth Building, from the 1920s, the jazz era, the great New York era. Here was a post office built by the WPA. Here was Federal Hall, where George Washington took the first oath of office and said he could see in what had brought about America the hand of Providence. And here was the Fulton Fish Market, where Al Smith worked. Al Smith, the son of an immigrant, a teamster who worked himself to death, the teamster did, and Al, a young man who only matriculated, as he said, from FFM, Fulton Fish Market, could go up to be the governor of a great state and the presidential candidate of our oldest party, Al Smith, and that memory of New York. And then looking out, there was the Brooklyn Bridge, Hart Crane's Bridge, and there out in the harbor, you could strain and you could almost imagine those Dutch sailors when they first came here and looked out and saw that cream, that breast of the New World, as Scott Fitzgerald said, and at last men were, as he says, face to face with something commensurate with their capacity to wonder. And there it all was.
The breast of a new world with a wound in it this last year, we hope beginning to heal. Jack, it's been great having you in New York this week. Stand by for a moment. I want to introduce our first guest this evening. We're talking about the soul of a nation tonight. We come at this with some humility, but hoping that we can touch something here. I'm joined in the studio by Diana Eck. She's professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard. Since 1991, she's led the Harvard research team that studies religious diversity in America. Good evening and welcome, Diana Eck.
Good to be here.
We have the temerity to take this on tonight, and I don't know where we can actually go with it, but so many people that we've spoken to over all these months have said, 9/11 felt like a soul-deep challenge that would call up a soul-deep response from this country that would engage our deepest spirits, whether we're religious or not, but go really right to our bottom. Has it been a soul-deep response? Have we searched our souls in the way that we promised we would in the weeks, in the month after 9/11?
It's hard to know how we search our souls or where we take the pulse of that, Tom, but I think if we were to think about a religious response, I think that response has been in the connection, the deep sense of connection that people have made, not just the sort of few days after September 11th when everyone was tender to one another in elevators and on the sidewalks, but in the kinds of connections that have continued from that day to this day. I think about, for example, when all those names were read today, the fact that the Muslim Public Affairs Council of Los Angeles created a quilt, women and men who had never quilted before, with every one of those names on it, made by the Islamic Center in Southern California and brought to Ground Zero.
By Muslim hands.
By Muslim hands. I think of the kind of connection that has been made in cities and towns across the country that have created in this last year, some sort of ongoing interfaith across religion infrastructure, a sense that we need to reach out to one another, that mosques were having open houses within a week of September 11th, and now on this anniversary, again, Muslims and the National Council of Churches, the Presbyterian Church USA, all saying what we need to do is open our doors and connect with one another.
So the connection at that level of human souls touching one another, you see something out of the ordinary having happened in this
last year. Out of the ordinary in the sense that I feel, despite the fact that there were incidents that frayed our fabric deeply, that the fabric of the United States across religions and across connections between people is so much stronger today. I was reading an account in the Myrtle Beach newspaper from a Muslim man who said, a year ago, people thought we were from another planet. And now people are calling me up and saying, will you come to our home? Will you speak in our church, in our synagogue? And it's that difference that I think will make a lasting difference. I don't know how you say, is this soul deep or not? But it is very, very important, the kind of connection that has emerged from this.
Weaving the nation closer across religious lines. Diana Eck, there's so much to talk about this hour. We have so many guests who are going to join us, and I want to go straight to them, if we may. We're so glad you're here. We're joined now by Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He was a longtime civil rights advocate, has been an international peace movement activist, formerly chaplain at Yale University and senior minister of New York's Riverside Church. Good evening and welcome, William Sloan Coffin.
And a very great admirer of Diane Eck.
Well, we are your admirers, William Sloan Coffin, and awfully happy to have you. William Sloan Coffin, is it too broad a question to ask what's the health of the soul of the nation a year after 9/11? Has our soul searching lived up to your expectations?
Well, the question is easier to ask than the answer is to give. Mm. No, I think that Abraham Lincoln said once, "I've been driven to my knees out of a sense of there being no other place to go." And that's what happened at September 11th, a year ago. People went into the house of worship largely out of a sense of no other place to go. The same thing happened when Kennedy was shot. I can remember when Roosevelt died in April 44, 45, people went to church again. I think what Diane said about human solidarity, interconnection, is very, very important. And I think they found the solace that they sought and deserved. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. Mm. He restores my soul. It's a religious function of God to comfort the afflicted.
But it's also,
I think that part of it went very well. The other part of the religious side didn't go so well.
And that being William Sloan Coffin?
Well, to go back to the 23rd Psalm, "He leadeth me in the path of righteousness." God not only comforts the afflicted, but afflicts the comfortable. You know, people, you said early on that people wondered how God could let this happen. Mm-hmm. It's so important for us to realize that God doesn't go around the world with a finger on triggers, hands on round knives, or on the controls of airplanes. We do that. We humans do that. God doesn't. God supplies maximum support, but minimum protection. And God does not suspend human freedom to save us from our own worst instincts.
William Sloan Coffin, you've written about what's required of people of faith and of the moral issues here. After 9/11, you wrote, or you preached, you said, "Evil is the absence of imaginative sympathy for others." Clearly, that imaginative sympathy for innocent Americans was missing on 9/11. What about Americans' imaginative sympathy for the rest of the world since 9/11?
Well, I think that a year ago, because there were 85 different nationalities and represented among the dead in New York City, we had these wonderful interreligious services. Remember, Yankee Stadium with Oprah Winfrey. And I think then we were deeply touched by how touched others in other countries were at our plight. Mm-hmm. But since then, I think we have not been able to share the sorrow of other countries as much as we share our own sorrow, to make it kind of judgmental. I'm afraid we over-dramatize our own tragedy at the expense of other people's tragedies all around the world.
And the consequence of that?
That we're not in the same solidarity one year later with other religions. I think Diane would probably agree with that here at home. And we're certainly, when we're about to embark, possibly, on a unilateral, preemptive military strike without the friends we had a year ago and no Arab countries with us, that's a big, big change from where we were a year ago.
William Sloan Coffin, it's been an honor to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining On Point.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about the soul of a nation. What have you asked of God, or simply of your deepest self, in the year since 9/11? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the soul of a nation. Is there an opening in this disaster? Has there been in this last year? Is there still for something transformative? For spiritual energy, moral energy? Do you feel closer to your family, your country, your God, your world? Are you reaching out or reaching in? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Diana Eck. She's author of A New Religious America and head of Harvard's Pluralism Project, a research team exploring the new religious diversity in the United States. Diana Eck, this issue of the spirit of vengeance, of justice, of forgiveness all have been on the table in the last year. As you look out with a religious perspective that spans particular faiths and maybe even beyond faith, how do you find the nation's response to the assault that it took on 9/11?
I think the immediate response to talk about a campaign that was first called Infinite Justice, mm-hmm. and that, of course, that name was quickly withdrawn because people realized how, at least the government realized how deeply offensive that was to many religious people. And there were religious voices in the United States and around the world even then that said, let's not classify this as a war. Let's not classify this as an act of war. Let's classify this, as the United Nations does even today, as a crime against humanity, the deepest and worst crime against humanity, and address it that way. Mm-hmm. Because it's very clear that the spirit of vengeance finally will not take us to where we want to go. And even though people will look at the revenge that we took as not vengeance but justice, mm-hmm. and trying to liberate Afghanistan from the Taliban, etc., there's a lot of talk of a war against evil, a war against terrorism, that seems to many people to be an ongoing fight against something that is so amorphous that we are at risk of not seeing any of this in ourselves.
But religions also raise the concept of just war. Are we within those confines, within those boundaries?
I think that's a matter that's been very roundly and fully and perhaps not fully enough debated. Who we are in that context, of course, is a very important thing. It's not just we, the United States of America, but we, the international community. One of the things, I mean, to bring this to a local level that mm-hmm. I think of as sort of how can we draw some lessons from this? There was a Sikh Gurdwara that was burned down in upstate New York.
It's a house of worship for Sikhs.
A house of worship for the Sikh community.
The turban sect that came in for a lot of grief
exactly.
last fall because of ignorance about who they were and
that's right. And
what
the people, there were young kids in that community who saw these turbaned people at the Gurdwara mm-hmm. as somehow the cousins of Osama bin Laden, who were now our enemies. Mm-hmm. And they burned the place down. They were caught. Those who were the leaders of that community immediately were surrounded by community of well-wishers and supporters from across the area in this little town of Palermo, New York, and finally went to court to say, we want to see some leniency for these young people because they had no idea. They are the victims of some of the kind of ignorance that our society has bred. Mm. And that led to the head of the school board in Palermo going to India to learn more about the Sikhs and people from India coming to Palermo to support the Sikh community, but a sense in which our local world, our global world, are deeply interrelated. And the notion of our interdependence is perhaps one of the most important things that all of us need to learn. We are not secure in the United States if the rest of the world is at risk. And, you know, we can see that reality, that realpolitik, in a sense, at work in the Middle East. And and at work in so many places in the world.
There's where the spiritual touches the realpolitik.
Where the spiritual and the realpolitik mm-hmm. come together, mm-hmm. where we know perfectly well that no one has security if their neighbors are suffering.
Jack Beattie, we've gone through this year together, and we've heard high spirits and low spirits and soulful contemplation. But there is an evolution over this year. What's your sense of the spiritual upshot of 9/11?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a feeling about the vengeance. I would disagree respectfully with Diana about the reaching out to the Muslim community. If you turn on AM radio, I'm afraid, and listen to these talk shows, you'll hear the American unconscious. And it's ugly, and it's mean, and it's full of hate. And that you could see some of that here. I mean, there were a kind of jaunty graffito. It said, "Our women shave." But, you know, when I think of this, of our spiritual dilemma now, I, as a secular guy, I look through these things through the eyes of Reinhold Niebuhr, the sort of theologian for secular people. And Niebuhr, in his famous book, The Irony of American History, talked about how throughout American history, we have had righteous ends, war to end war, and, war against evil. Yeah. But again and again, the means we have used have undercut those ends because those means have been wicked and questionable and morally dubious. And, of course, here we are right now in that dilemma where our righteous end is to deliver the world from terrorism. Our righteous end is to free the Iraqi people from this terrible dictator. But our means are going to be just the kind of means that happened here. Not deliberate murder of civilians, but just the same murder by aerial bombardment of men and women and children. And that, that's the ends and means dilemma that Niebuhr is, I think, the man of our moment, because he points again and again to how the righteous ends and the unlovely means don't fit so well together with and how great virtue and great power do not comport with each other.
But how difficult to restrain from those heavy metal means when the assault is so terrible. I want to welcome into our conversation now Rabbi David Gelfand. He's senior rabbi of the Jewish Center of the Hamptons, founder of the Interfaith Alliance in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome, Rabbi Gelfand.
Good evening. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for being with us. Rabbi Gelfand, we're raising big questions tonight, and I guess the biggest one is, how do you assess the spiritual health of the nation, the health of the nation's soul a year after 9/11?
Well, having just come from a very large communal interfaith gathering, I can share with you that at least in the realm in which I live and work, that there is a great deal of soul searching. There's certainly still anger over the wounds inflicted on our country, whether it is from the realm of simply American bravado, but I would hope even much more deeply a denial of the value of human life, and also an affront to the values of freedom. I think people are, it has caused people to be very reflective about things that are important to them. And I think every time we see the plethora of film, movies, books, you can't walk into a bookstore, you can't walk into any kind of event that certainly in the last few weeks without people talking about things related to 9/11. But the truth is that's been going on since 9/11, certainly heightened more in the past few weeks.
Rabbi Gelfand, you live in a community, the Hamptons, famous for its glitz and wealth, but we know it's not all that. What's the direction of the soul searching that you feel going on in your congregation?
I have seen certainly people, a higher rate of people attending regular worship, greater numbers of people who are interested in studying and learning about sacred texts. People who are really concerned about sort of existential issues from a course that we offered this summer that I don't know would have gotten half as many the year before. That was a very serious, sophisticated course taught by a world-renowned scholar on ethics.
And are the links being drawn between ethics, existential issues, personal faith, and 9/11 and its meaning and a changed world,
Way or another, it keeps coming up. It's not that people don't walk in the door and say, "I'm here because of 9/11. Certainly that happened for us I think, in a very dramatic way in the Jewish community, because last year 9/11 was but a week before the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah. And so that was very dramatic and certainly reflected again as it is this year. It happens to fall right near the holidays again. In fact, today is the day midway between the Jewish New Year and the Day of Atonement, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And there's even irony in that the date 9/11 on the Hebrew calendar, the ninth day of the 11th month is a day known as Tisha B'Av, which is a mourning day for the destruction of the ancient temple in Jerusalem. It sort of deals with the idea of burning buildings and people fleeing for their lives and reframing history and then living in a shadow thereafter and taking great deals of time to recuperate, as it were, and readjust.
We know that a year is just a blink of an eye at a spiritual level, but do you see in this disaster, in this tragedy, the potential for something transformative? Do you see people grasping the challenge of the moment, of the year, of the assault, to look for a moral energy, a spiritual meaning, a spiritual transformation?
Again, the illustration last week in front of several thousand people for Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, I gave a sermon on forgiving forgetfulness forgiving forgetting and reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've been a rabbi for 26 years. Over the years, I have given sermons like that on the high holidays of similar themes. I have never had the kind of response that I have gotten this year. It has been a profoundly transformative response, people telling me about how, you know, they've never stopped in their tracks before. I mean, I don't think I said it that much better. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope I did better than any time before, but I always hope that.
But maybe the souls are simply more open.
I think unquestionably people are. I think that I read something that I found very profound that helped me trying to think about how do you help people move from that sort of moment of history? And it was that after Kennedy was assassinated, a group of his advisors were sitting around having a conversation, and someone said, "We'll never be the same again." And they kind of muttered it. And somebody said, "What'd you say?" He said, "We'll never be the same again." And then someone else corrected him and said, "No, we'll never be this young again." And I think we are a year older. It's 9/11, 2002, not one. But I think much more, we're not as naive as we were a year ago, and there's a sadness to that, but there's also something that allows us to move beyond that. The truth is that after every experience we have in life, we're never the same again, and if we're the same again, then something's not right.
That was a big one.
But I think that some of our national leaders and I think some writers very powerfully and people of all walks of life, and the visuals that we've seen time and again kind of help us remember, I think, because we've come to the realization that heroes are not things made in the movies, a la John Wayne or something, but heroes are everyday flesh and blood people, as we came to understand more than ever before, and that not being the same doesn't mean that we give up all hope for the future. But it means that we have to think about how can we build for a future. And I don't say that naively. I think there are great struggles, and I'm quite anxious about the thought of a war that moves beyond the war on terrorism. And I think part of my fear is also that the war, if it were to move into the realm of Iraq or elsewhere, is that it may move us from perhaps the greater threat, which is the threat of terrorism against the terrorists, that is, of against the values that so much of what we hold to be dear.
Rabbi David Gelfand, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It has been my pleasure.
Rabbi David Gelfand is Senior Rabbi of the Jewish Center of the Hamptons. I want to turn now to Imam Alhaj Talib Abdul Rashid. He's spiritual leader of the Mosque of the Islamic Brotherhood in Harlem. It's a Sunni Muslim mosque, and he is a pioneering activist in interfaith work on the board of a partnership of faith in New York City. Good evening and welcome, Imam.
Good evening. Peace be on to you all.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're trying to take the temperature of the soul of the nation a year on from 9/11 tonight and asking if we have... if we've ridden the terrible energy of that day to a sharper sense of our responsibilities, of our life at the deepest level, what is your sense, Imam Abdul Rashid?
I'm not so sure that we have. Perhaps on kind of the upside, we're at the beginning of a process. I listened to you a couple of minutes ago, and you mentioned the word transformative. Mm-hmm. I think that perhaps, we're just at the beginning of that process. All of us who have experience with death and loss know that there is a grieving period that people go through on an individual basis, during which there's a great deal of shock and frankly, not too much contemplation. And I think that perhaps just now the nation as a whole is moving to a point where it's ready to move beyond grief and into a period of contemplation.
I guess part of going deep in our feelings and thinkings means honesty. Do you feel a worthy honesty in the American conversation about 9/11 and its meaning, about the country's self-reflection?
Well, it really depends on who's doing the talking. I think that there are efforts, and really over the past year have been efforts to sort of get an honest conversation going, but led by government, led by public officials who have been really saying the politically expedient thing as opposed to a search for truth. I don't think the conversation has been very honest up until now. The public discourse, even now a year later, too often still tends to be one that points a lone finger at the other and that never asks the tough questions.
The tough questions like?
Well, the tough questions like what the rest of the world seems to know. Last week, there was the results of a poll, an international poll were released, for instance, in Europe, in which many of the European nations were asked, did they feel that there was any relationship whatsoever between American foreign policy and the events of 9/11? They overwhelmingly said yes. There's a story, an interview that was just released with Nelson Mandela, in which he said the same thing. However, I took note that on the particular network that I was watching this, when the story broke, even the commentators kind of took umbrage at the very idea. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it that the rest of the world is looking at or that the rest of the world seems to know that we in America don't know?
Imam Al-Haj Talib Abdul Rashid, thank you so much for joining us from New York tonight.
You're welcome.
Diana Eck, there's the question of honesty. We can't have a soul-deep conversation if we're not being wholly honest. Do you feel a full, frank honesty in America's conversation with itself, with the world?
I think Imam Talal Abdul Rashid has put his finger on something that's very, very important, and that is that we in the United States have, and we can see it today, have a very deep sense of how things affect us and all of the ritualism of today, beautiful, beautiful as it was, and important as it was for us, doesn't really touch that question of honesty. Imam Rashid and I were together at a meeting in Malaysia just a month ago. And to look at the United States from the standpoint of Malaysia, or later from, in my case, from the standpoint of India, it's very clear that we have not asked the larger question as honestly, frankly, and deeply as we must, which is how do we, in this country, fit into the broader picture of a global world in which we really are all in it together? And we can give rose petals for ourselves, but people abroad will sometimes say, what do you think about us?
We're talking tonight about the soul of a nation. Did 9/11 undercut your faith or bolster it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight, 1 year on from 9/11, about the soul of the nation. Did you turn to prayer, to worship, after September 11th, 2001? Do you still? How do you judge the spiritual health of the nation today? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Diana Eck. She's professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard and author of A New Religious America. And right now on the line by Bridget. Welcome, Bridget. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
You posed a question that made me think about what it is that I've done in my own world since 9/11. And I thought it was a good one. And the thing that I've done is, instead of thinking about God and how can I be a better worshiper, which I don't subscribe to that, mm-hmm. Is I have questioned, how does my own prejudice that is unconscious in my everyday life affect my world?
What have you found, Bridget?
Well, I found that small things like, if we see some, I've been out and I've seen a heavy person, someone who's overweight or obese, and I've thought, I don't take that person seriously. I think that that's a form of prejudice. I think the prejudice of walking down the street and seeing someone of a different race, maybe black, and feeling intimidated for no reason, other than, you know, with stories that we hear. And I think that these are the everyday prejudices that we live with, and that we, as a country, deny it.
And Bridget, when you add up those small steps, does it feel to you like a deeply important response to what happened on 9/11, to the kind of changes we see in the world now?
Yeah, I think it does feel deep to me. It feels better to me to do that and know that I'm also, what's come out of it is being able to take myself more seriously and look at, hey, who am I electing to my government as a person of, you know, I'm an American. What is my government doing that I don't know about? That's because, like you said, all these foreign countries are saying, you know, it is your foreign policy, and I don't know what my foreign policy is.
Bridget, thank you for your call, and thank you for your comments. Diana Eck, here's one American citizen saying, I'm not even religious, but I take it at this level as a matter of being more conscious of myself, of my interactions with the world.
Absolutely important. So important. I mean, that kind of recognition of some of our own prejudices is something we don't do nearly as enough of. I mean, all of us walk around with half-baked ideas about who our neighbors are, whether they're of another race or whether they're Muslim or Sikh or Hindu. You know, in the aftermath of 9/11, it wasn't just mosques or Islamic centers that were targeted in this country. There were Gujarati grocery stores that were run by South Asian immigrants from India who had, you know, were a far cry from the perpetrators of 9/11. But the sense that these others are just other, and I think the recognition of that prejudice is terribly important. The other side of it, of course, is to recognize that people all over the world have those same half-baked, stereotypical, prejudicial ideas.
We are not alone in that way either.
Well, we are, you know, and you can bet a lot of the people who drove the planes into the buildings had an idea of America.
A huge idea.
A huge idea of America that was shaped by a set of stereotypes, realities, prejudices that we have no control over.
We all have to pick these apart. Jim's on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Well, hi. How you doing?
Well, thank you.
Just turned the radio on. Just ready to go into church with respect to our spiritual soul. I think we need to all get back on our knees. We're basically becoming an immoral society and very decadent, influenced by Hollywood, and all you see is violence and sex, and look what's going on ever since Columbine, et cetera. I think we need to, as people did right after 9/11, flock to churches of their own denomination. And now it's somewhat dissipated. We can't forget. We've got to keep that up, and we've got to get back to some basic moral fiber.
But is that distance you described, Jim, was it related to what happened on 9/11? Is it related to how we pull away from that precipice?
What, the flood into churches?
Well, no, what you describe is the amoral society.
I think we've been amoral for a long time, and I think the other problem is we have a very apathetic majority, very apathetic. And I think you saw the majority respond after 9/11 and get back in to the synagogues and the churches of various denominations and the mosques. And I think we need to stay there. We need to focus on what's important, each other and our relationship with the Almighty, and start treating people the way they treated right after the tragedy. I mean, we've gone back to our old ways to a certain degree. And
Jim, thank you for your call. Let me put it to Jack Beatty. Jack, we know that the numbers shot up of attendance in churches and synagogues and mosques after 9/11. It's reportedly settled back down now to pretty much status quo ante. Is that an important indicator of deep American engagement with the world, with self-examination?
Well, I think it can be for some people. Others might say, you know, that churches are one of the things that separates us. Certainly, historically, churches have separated human beings over very trivial matters of doctrine to people like me on the outside. So churches can unify, but they can also divide mankind, and they have. I think I'm with Bridget. I mean, she's used this occasion to do a kind of moral inventory. To say to herself, well, I can't live in the big world, but I can live in my world, and I can change something that I do by reflection. And early on in this program, I think the first night we were on, we talked to an Irish poet who said how much he loved America and Americans. He said, but you know, you don't like reflection. And that dimension, I just am so glad to hear from Bridget, and I think we all want to show some of that reflection about ourselves, but also about our country.
Taneyak, our time is terribly short, but do you see that reflection going on, reflection equal to the moment in history?
There certainly is some. It's amazing this year how much theological discourse has gone on in public. You have, I mean, to some extent, people don't go to churches because they are uneasy.
It's all right there in the public square.
Well, it's out there in the public square, and sometimes they don't like what religious leaders are saying as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've had all of this sort of theological confusion spewing forth out of the religious right about Allah isn't really God, etc. And I think people are looking for something that's deeper and more in tune with the reality that they see in the world around us, which is a multi-faith world in which we have to have better answers than many of our church and synagogue leaders have given us.
Here's a hope that we all find that something deeper, whatever it is we're looking for. Diana Eck, author of A New Religious America, thank you for being with us tonight. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. The date September 11th will always be synonymous with loss for Americans. For Massachusetts resident Gary Ainsworth, 9/11 was a painful day even before last year's attacks. On September 11th of 2000, Ainsworth and his wife Deb lost their 10-month-old child, Max, to heart problems. In this radio diary, Gary Ainsworth reflects on the lessons in grief he's learned from the personal and national losses of two September 11ths.
Last September 11th, at a bed and breakfast in the Berkshires, my wife Deb and I watched in horror as the morning's events unfolded, and the nation joined us in a state of disbelief and grief that we've been living with for the last 12 months. Sadly, we were not vacationing. We were escaping from all things routine and familiar. We were attempting at the same time to remember and perhaps forget the most miserable day of our lives, September 11, 2000. Exactly 1 year before the attacks, on what would turn out to be a beautiful late summer day, our son's deterministic journey through life ended peacefully in our arms. Max was 10 months old. The profound cardiac disease that had drained the life from him over the four previous months finally caught up with him early that morning, leaving his dad out of the only job I had enjoyed in years, being a stay-at-home parent. Max was a sweet and happy baby who said his first words at 6 months and was always quick to greet friends and family with a smile. He charmed everyone and was a very old soul. It certainly helped that he had huge brown eyes, long eyelashes, and a pointy chin, like a poster child for the Italian independent film industry. Yet although outwardly beautiful and seemingly perfect, Max was usually one of the sickest kids at Boston Children's Hospital's cardiac center. As grief consumes you, after something as unreal as losing a child, the world of the living moves on. The people closest to you sometimes become strangers, as more and more of your mind is consumed by trying to seal the hole in your life. You exist in a disembodied state few can understand. Deb and I were trying to continue our healing by getting away to a quote-unquote safe place those days last September. We were already raw from the environmental cues of the season. The warm days and cool nights of late summer were triggering memories and replaying sad images that were scorched into our minds. Our loss was upon us, and we were trying to cope with an event so unbelievable, at times I still cannot believe it happened. As I listened to the radio on the morning of September 11, 2001, I sensed something unreal. Carl Castle, the steady voice of reason on the radio, was unsure and anxious. He gave me the first indication that something terribly wrong was being piled onto our personal misery. So I turned on the TV just in time to see the second plane hit. Suddenly, a nation was coming to grips with our world. In the days following, it was odd to observe people. Many folks who had never experienced loss were rattled to their core. Younger folks panicked, as the extent of their adult reckoning was the fruitful 90s. People's values and ways of life were damaged beyond recognition. 9/11 now represented our loss and the nation's. My wife and I were now adrift in grief with millions, and suddenly we were in the company of a nation coping with loss. Initially, we had little tolerance. Our loss was being diminished by the day's events. At times, we felt like saying, "Welcome aboard." We had little emotional reserves left beyond our little family. But in the months since, I've realized something. Since Max's death, I found that our American culture can be somewhat unnatural. Our culture is driven by time, not nature. People believe a calendar year is somehow significant in the grieving process. My family has heard unkind remarks like, "It's been a year, aren't you over that yet?" implying Max was a vat, something to be forgotten. We, as a culture, are no longer trained in the art of dealing with grief and loss. Grief and loss are very inconvenient, and they ruin efficiency. So I found in these unnatural times, my son gave me a tremendous gift. I've become an expert on loss and the perspective loss gives you. I've learned that loss is loss, whether it's the loss of a child, a job, or a nation's way of life. I found that loss must be coped with so it doesn't grow into something problematic. As parts of me resurface in the world of the living, as I heal, I learned to concentrate on today and the joys of life. Lastly, I found that my family, and I presume the nation, will heal on its own time. For the first time in my life, I let the healing take its natural course and take as much time as I need. I try to remember Max's full life and his love of our little family, but I don't always succeed, but at least I have the perspective to know better.
Gary Ainsworth lives in Waltham, Massachusetts. We're ending this hour with sounds from New York City today as that city observes the one-year anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Ed Elmiro Abad. Maria Rose Abad. Andrew Anthony Abadi.
It's going to come up real soon. Here it is. There you go. He was a good guy, dude.
Marsha Clark.
God bless you.
John A.
Salvatore B. Calabro. Joseph Calendrijo. Philip B. Calgano. Edward Calderon. Kenneth.
We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Donald W. Jones.
Michael F. Lynch.
Vincent S. Morello.
Takashi Ogawa.
May God bless the victims. We love you all. May God bless America.
This is WBUR.